Moshe Rabbeinu is told by the Rabbanu Shel Olam, Vishamu Lekolecha, that the Jewish people will believe him, listen to him, obey him, go with him to Paro and demand that they be let free. And Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Rabbanu Shel Olam, V'hein lo yaminu li. I don't think they'll believe me. And they'll say that God didn't appear to you. Now, God had told him, V'shamu l'kolecha. God told him, I'm telling you they will believe you. So, who is Moshe Rabbeinu to argue and say, I think I know these people better, and I don't think they'll believe a word of this. If you were God, how would you react to Moshe Rabbeinu? What would you say? Well, who do you think you are? I told you to believe you. What are you telling me they won't? How does God respond to Moshe Rabbeinu? So he says, you know, you got a point. And if they don't believe you, so then here's one miracle. And if they don't believe this first miracle, here's a second miracle. And if they don't believe that, here's a third miracle. What happened? Before this, God said, Vishamul v'kalecha, that they'll believe you. So some say that the Rabbanu Shel Olam meant they'll believe you after three miracles. But he didn't have a chance to explain to Moshe Rabbeinu what the three miracles were until Moshe Rabbeinu questioned what he said, and then he explained it. But I have a different answer. And that is the following. Moshe Rabbeinu was to be the leader of the Jewish people. If Moshe Rabbeinu had said to the Rabbanu Shel Olam, I have faith in these people, and when you told me that they'll believe me, I believe that they'll believe me, then the people would have believed him. But if the leader doesn't have faith in the people, and the leader has doubts whether they'll believe him or not, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Then the Rabbanu Shel Olam says, now you'll need three miracles to have them believe. Had you had faith in them and said, yeah, they'll believe me, they would have believed you. A salesman can't sell a product that he doesn't believe in. And if Moshe Rabbeinu didn't believe in the people, he couldn't sell them the product and make them believe. So the Rabbanu Shel Olam told him, had you had the faith in them and you would have believed me that they'll believe you, then they would have believed you. Now that you're not so sure, you don't have the faith in them that they're going to believe you, then you're going to need three miracles to make them believe you. Okay. So what were the three miracles? The Rabbanu Shel Olam told him the following. If they don't believe the first one, the second one will get them. If they don't believe the second one, the third one for sure will get them. So the obvious question is, if the third one is so convincing, why just not skip the first two and go to the third one? Why bother with the first two? What was the first one? The first one was he threw his stick down and turned into a snake. Then he picked it up and turned back into a stick. Second one, he put his hand in his chest and it turned to be Mesora, to have Tsaras, basically dead flesh-like. And then he put it back and it turned back normal. And the third one, he poured water and it turned to blood when it hit the ground. So if the third one was so much more convincing that the Rabbanu Shel Olam can change water into blood, why bother with the first two? The same question you can ask by another Gemara. The Gemara says like this, La'olam yargiz adam yetzer hatov al yetzer hara. A person should always agitate his yetzer hatov over his yetzer hara and see to it he doesn't sin. Nitzcho mutav. If you're successful with that, right, a sin comes your way, right, you have this delicious ham sandwich in front of you and you have the temptation to eat it, so you should strengthen your Yetzer HaTov over your Yetzer Hara and not eat it. If that doesn't work, then Yilmid Torah, then learn some Torah. Torah is the antidote to the Yetzer Hara. You'll learn Torah, it will take away the temptation somewhat. You'll be able then to overcome it. Nitzcho Mutav. That helps, fine. If after you learn the Torah, you're still have that tremendous desire for that ham sandwich, then Yikra Kriya Shema. Read Shema. That should help. Nitzcho Mutav. That helps fine. If not, then remember the day of death. Remember that you're mortal. That would seem from this Gemara also. Remembering that you're mortal will pretty much get you away from the temptation of eating the ham sandwich. Because you'll realize that you're going to die someday, and this ham sandwich will just be a little bit more worms, so what's it worth it? Is it worth doing the sin when you're not going to be around anyway forever, so you might as well do what's right. So if that's the case, why bother with the Torah and the Kriya Shema? Just get down to the final thing and remember the day of death. So some say that remembering the day of death will bring you to be very morose and depressed. So that's not the first line of action. Better to learn Torah, read Kriya Shema, whatever. I have a different, two different answers. And these two answers also will answer the question by Moshe Rabbeinu. The first answer is, we were put in this world to make moral choices. Choices between good and bad. And that's where we get our reward and punishment, for making the right choices. The more intense the choice, the more reward. Right? The more that we make the right choice totally on our own, without any forcing, without any side coercion, you get rewarded for that. If there are side reasons why you didn't choose the wrong thing, then you don't get so much reward. Right? If you were forced to a certain degree, or there were whatever different kinds of perks or whatever that you would get, so the choice wasn't completely yours. It was influenced by side things. The reward is less. So the ideal is to make the choice on your own without any crutches. So therefore, the Gemara says you should try to agitate your Yetzer HaTov over the Yetzer HaRa without any crutches. Don't eat that ham sandwich. Make the decision totally on your own. If you're successful, fine. But if you're not successful, we don't want you to eat the ham sandwich. So then, learn Torah. Torah is a crutch in this respect. Learning Torah is a mitzvah all the time. But right now, you're learning Torah in order to weaken your Yetzer HaRa. So you're using the Torah as a crutch. Now, if you'll make the right decision, it's not the same strength of decision, because you've weakened your Yetzer HaRa by learning Torah. So that's second best. If that works, fine. If it doesn't, then read Kriya Shema. That's even a stronger crutch. Put the fear of God into you that you're going to get rewarded, punished, whatever. That's even a stronger crutch. And if that doesn't work, then remember the fact that you're mortal. Remember the day of death, which is even a stronger crutch. Better you should do what's right, even if your decision is minimal, then you shouldn't do what's right at all. Same thing over here with Moshe Rabbeinu. I want the people to believe on their own. I'm not going to give them any crutches. You're going to come to them and tell them what you have to say, and hopefully they'll believe. If they don't believe, give them a weaker crutch. If they don't believe that, a little bit stronger. And finally, the clincher, better they should believe. They shouldn't believe at all, but the ideal is they should do it on their own without any crutches. That's one way of understanding. Second way of understanding it is the following. If you would just remember the day of death in the Gemara's case, it may not make you not sin, just the opposite. It could bring you yes to sin, or to negative responses. Remembering that you're mortal is not going to necessarily prevent you from sinning, unless you look at it in the right perspective. And if you don't have the first things, then there's always the danger you'll look at it the wrong perspective. If you don't first agitate your Yetzer HaTov over Yetzer HaRa, and learn Torah, and read Kriya Shema, remembering the day of death, without those three prefaces, it may be completely negative. Only after you have those first three things is remembering the day of death effective. How so? Remembering the day of death, remembering that you're mortal, that you're not going to live forever, could have three negative effects on you, and it evoke three negative responses. The first negative response is Kochi Votzim Yodi, right? I'm mortal, but I can control it. And if I jog, and I eat health foods, and I take, omega-3, I will live forever. Nothing can harm me. All I have to do is eat healthy, jog, and whatever. I'm not saying that one shouldn't do those things. You can do it. But some people take it to an extreme where they think that if they do this, that's it. Nothing can hurt them. There was a famous person who devised a whole system of jogging and exercise or whatever, and showed that jogging brings a person longer life. And Lamaisa, he died, I think, in the 50s, jogging. In the midst of jogging, he dropped dead. So jogging is not going to guarantee that you are going to live longer. If it's a positive thing, it's a healthy thing, there's nothing wrong with doing it, just the opposite, probably it's good to do. But no one should ever think that they're going to jog themselves into Olam Haba, right? That by doing everything healthy, you're going to control your health. You're not in control of anything in this world. The thing that reminds you that is, agitate your Yetzer HaTov or Yetzer Hara. What does that remind you? Shehakol bidei shamayim, chutz miyira shamayim. The only things that you have control of in this world is your moral choices. Everything else is in God's hands. So if you remind yourself of that, you won't let being mortal bring you to denial and make you do things that think that you can control your mortality. Not the case. First, that's the first thing. Second negative response to recognizing your mortality, depression. You wake up in the morning, you say, oh, I may die today, you know, what's the worst of worst, doing anything, going to work, whatever, making money, I maybe got my paycheck before I drop dead, and you know, my kids will get it, somebody, my wife will get it, right, I want to build something, I want to build a new house, I may drop dead before I have a chance to live in it, what's the worst of anything? So a person remembers he's a mortal human being, and that one day he's going to die, and he turns over and gets back into bed and can't face the world, and there's no tachlis of doing anything, and everything is worthless, and he becomes very depressed, and he just resigns from the human race, because I'm going to die anyway. The response that will, the thing that will take away that response is learning Torah. Go learn some Torah. What does Torah show you? The world's very important. Every physical thing in the world can be translated and used to make eternity. So this world's very important. Even if you're going to die, but whatever you do before you die will ensure that you'll have a share in the world to come after you die, which will be eternal. And the Torah makes every physical, material thing in this world important, because if you use it properly, you can use it in a way that will become eternity. So just the fact you're going to die, and maybe you won't be able to finish things in this world, but whatever you do in this world remains with you for the next world too, if you do it properly. So that's learning Torah. The third negative response from remembering that you are mortal is eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Okay, I'm going to die one day, so I might as well enjoy myself before I go. So, no limits. Eat, drink, be merry, enjoy yourself. Reading Kriya Shema takes care of that. Kriya Shema reminds you that there's reward, there's punishment. Don't go after your eyes, don't go after your heart. Because if you don't do what's right, God will hold back the reins, and you'll be exiled, and you'll be destroyed, and a lot of reward and punishment tells you that the world is not hefker. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die is not a legitimate response. Once you have negated those three negative responses by agitating your Yetzer HaTov, Yetzer Hara, negating the response that I'll control it, denial, I can control my mortality. And the second negative response, that nothing's worth anything and just get depressed and resign from the human race because I'm going to die anyway, learn Torah, that will negate that. And eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, negated by reading Kriya Shema, now remembering the day of death will be success. What's a positive part of it? This world is very important. Time is short. You better make the most of it. That's what remembering the day of death should bring you to in a very positive way. Now, I was thinking the same thing over here. I haven't yet polished it off, so I'm going to use you as my first sounding board for this idea. The same thing, I think, applies over here. What's the meaning of these, miracles that God did? What do they want to tell Paro? And the fact that the water turned to blood, what could you misunderstand about that, that the first two things will tell you differently? Okay, so let's see. The rod has a few different purposes to it. You can, support yourself with a staff. right? A mata is could be a staff of support. You could beat somebody and punish them with a staff, right? Hit them with it. And a, what's it called? Or you can guide things with a staff. Guide, and what's it called? And show, what's it called? Lead sheep with it, or whatever. Guide people with it, or whatever. Those are the three purposes of a staff. They all are positive things. They're a support for a person, mainly. They are guidance for other people, or a means of punishing other people by a person who knows better and wants to teach somebody a lesson. They're all a tool in the head of the person who's holding it. For himself, for others. Positive, negative. What's a snake? A snake is the archetype, is the symbol of man's enemy. Snake is a symbol of the Yetzer Hara, man's enemy spiritually and also physically. There's an enmity between the snake and the descendants of Chava for all time. Most people don't like snakes. Right? Snake is an omen of danger. Represents danger, something dangerous to a human being. The antithesis of a human being, snake. So the Rav Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, I want you to take your staff, I want you to show Paro that something not living, that can be a support for a human being, that can be, what's it called, a guidance for other people, that can educate people by hitting them sometimes because they're doing the wrong things, that same thing can become a living thing and the worst enemy to a person. I can take something that's not living, that when it's in its non-living state can be very, very positive, and turn it to something living and very negative. The opposite is just the opposite. A hand is a living thing, and it's a person's support, right? Person supports himself with his what he does with Maisa Yodayim. The Gemara calls your payroll, your wages, your earnings is Maisa Yodayim, what you do with your hands. Your handiwork is what you create in this world. So you have a living thing that can create, you can guide people with your hand too, you can support yourself with the work of your hands, and I'm going to take that living thing and turn it into something dead, and that's just a burden, just an empty luggage carrying on your arm. When you have an arm that's mitzora, it's like dead flesh. So that same living arm, that when it's alive, it's a tremendous support, I'm going to make it a burden to you by making it dead. The Rabban Hashem can take that which is dead and a support when it's dead and turn it to something alive that is an enemy. I can take something alive that's a support when it's alive and make it into a burden and make it dead. And now the water with the blood. So once you have this preface, I'll tell you what the water to the blood represents. God created a world, and he created two kinds of liquid that give life, water and blood. God's contribution is blood. Person is born with a supply of blood that he doesn't have to add to or subtract from during his life under normal circumstances. It's like one of these worry-free batteries, right? Car batteries. The old car batteries, you had to every once in a while add water. But now they made them totally sealed, and they're worry-free. You don't have to worry if there's water, not water. There's always water. That's really not my experience 100% true. I like to say what the worry-free batteries are that you can worry for free. They don't charge you at all for the worrying, and if you want to, you can worry for free, but they're still not 100% foolproof. But in any case, that's what it's supposed to be. It has its own water supply, and you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to add water, subtract water. For the life of the battery, it will always have water. For the life of a person, he will always have that supply of life giving blood. The body itself replenishes it and keeps it going, And you don't really, unless you are sick, you don't need a transfusion, you don't need extra blood, you don't need to take away out blood. Everything is fine as long as you're healthy. But under normal, good circumstances, right, the best circumstances, you don't have to do anything. That's God's contribution. That's the liquid that gives you life. But God wants us to be dynamic. He wants us to promote our life. So he made it that we're not just going to live like this. We have to do something to continue living. That is, drink water. Water is our contribution. We drink water, right, which shows that we have to preserve our lives. We have to do things that will enhance God's contribution. God wants us to be dynamic. That's what water represents. So water is what we introduce. Blood is what God introduced. Okay. As long as a person understands that he has to enhance his life and build on what God gave him. But God gave him the basis. And therefore, God made the framework. And you have to work within that framework. And the water that you drink, meaning the enhancement of your life and what you do in this world to make your life meaningful, whatever, has to be within the guidelines of what God gave you. Okay, in one respect, that is the idea of what a Torah is. I give you a story to go along with it, but what the Torah, the basis for keeping the Torah is not just because God can zap you with a lightning bolt and you better listen to him, otherwise, you know, he could really get even with you or whatever. That is one idea of keeping the Torah, but it's not the major idea. The major idea would be the following. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, I had the opportunity to buy a new car, first and last new car I ever bought in my life. I don't have it anymore. It was about 28 years ago. It was a Ford Transit. They made them in England, but they assembled them in Eretz Yisrael, so they were much cheaper. And I had rights as a new immigrant, an Ole Chadash, and I didn't have to pay tax on the car. The coal car, new car, Ford Transit, cost $8,000. That was it. So it was kedai to buy a new car. I never would be able to buy a new car otherwise, and here I had a chance to buy a new car. Not only a new car, but it had, I could legally take 11 people in the car. 11 people with the driver. And we had Kanai Nahara 11 children. So that means that 13, if my wife and myself went with my children somewhere, we had to have 13 children. So only two over to be illegal in this car. So I ordered the car. And they called me and told me it's ready. I should come pick it up. And they let me know that I had to pay the full price in cash. Not in a check, in cash. No down payment, no payments. That was the way it was in Israel those days. You had to pay the full price on the when you purchased. And it had to be paid in shekel. Now, the exchange rate in those days, shekel to the old shekel to the dollar, was 1,000 shekel to a dollar. That was the exchange rate. 1,000 old shekel to the dollar. And the car, like I said, cost 8,000 shekel, $8,000. And there was no bill bigger than a 1,000 shekel bill. The 1,000 shekel bill is what the 100 shekel bill is today. But it was a 1,000 shekel bill. So I cashed in $8,000 for 8 million shekel in 1,000 shekel bills. I had stacks and stacks of 1,000 shekel bills. I had an attaché case filled with money. I felt like a drug dealer going through the streets going to Tel Aviv. I get to Tel Aviv with my attaché case full of money, and I put it on the table, open it up, and the guy starts looking through, make sure there's no blanks over here, it's all there, counts up the money. 8 million shekel, fine. He gives me the keys to the car. Here's your car. It's in space so-and-so outside. I'm just ready to get to the door, and he calls me back, and he says, I forgot something. I said, what did you forget? And I was ready for anything, because when I ordered the car, I saw that this is not normal. Right? The guy, when I ordered the car, said to me, do you want the basic car, or would you like to order any extras? So I said, I've never bought a new car in my life. I don't know what extras there could be. I would imagine you're talking about a stereo, power window, something, you know, what the extras could be. Could you give me an idea of what are extras? He says, yeah, do you want windows? I said, windows? He said, yeah, if you get the basic car, it comes with the windshield and the back window, but there's no side windows. If you want side windows, that's extra. Okay? So if windows are extra, I have no idea what this guy is going to surprise me with now. He said, I forgot something. I said, what'd you forget? He said, I forgot to give you this. He takes out a big, thick book. I said, what's that? He said, that is the owner's manual to your new car. I said, what's that? He said, well, it tells you what kind of gasoline to put in the gas tank and what kind of oil to put in the crankcase, what kind of detergent to use on the upholstery, and a million other things, what kind of bulbs to use or whatever. I felt like telling the guy, what a chutzpah. I just gave you 8 million shekel in cool cash for this car. You're going to tell me what to put in my gas tank? I'll put whatever I want in my gas tank. It's my car. Who are you to tell me what to put in the gas tank? Now, that's true. It is my car, and I can put whatever I want in the gas tank. But unfortunately, I didn't design the car. Had I designed the car, maybe I could have designed it to run on water. But I didn't design it. The Ford Motor Company designed it. And they designed it, unfortunately, to run on gasoline, and a specific grade of gasoline. So I can do whatever I want. I could put water in. I could put whatever I want in my gas tank, but it's not going to go anywhere because I am bound to the design of the designer. And unless I can redesign the car, I have to do what the Ford Motor Company tells me to do in that book. Otherwise, the car won't go anywhere. And even if it will go, I put the wrong grade of gas, it'll go, but it'll burn out the motor slowly. That's what the Torah is. God created the world. He designed me and everything else in it. Unless I can redesign everything, I am bound to his design. So he gave us an owner's manual to the world to tell me what he designed me to eat and what he designed me not to eat. What he designed me to wear, what he designed me to say, to think, to work, when to work, when not to work. Now, I can do what I want. I have free choice. But if I don't follow the design of the designer, I may be burning out my motor and never get to where I'm supposed to go. So that is one way of looking at the Torah. The Torah is the owner's manual to the world. So therefore, I am bound to work within the framework. God gave me life. He gave me a liquid called blood that I don't have to touch. I didn't have anything to do with. That is the foundation of my life. He also wants me to be dynamic and enhance that life. He wants me to be involved in preserving that life, of promoting that life. So he gave me water that I can introduce into this system. But I should realize that I'm introducing it to his system. I have to keep it within his framework, not a different framework. I can't redesign myself. I can't work outside the framework. I'm going to have the water according to the design of the designer that fits the blood, that's not, antithetical to the blood. So that is the idea of blood and water. So the Rabban Shem says to Paro, if you people want to exchange water for blood, in other words, you deny that I am the creator. You deny that I made the design. You want to conceptually take the blood that I put and you want to make that into water as if it's yours, and you can do what you want with it, then let's see what happens when I turn your water into blood, see how far you get. If you turn my blood into water, I'm going to turn your water into blood. That's the lesson of the water turning to blood. You turn my blood, my foundation of life, into your water. You think you can do what they want with it. Then I'm going to change your water into blood, see how far you get. It won't give you any life. You won't be able to promote your life with blood. That's the message. But you can come to another message. You can come to the message that you have no choice. You are just a puppet. You're just a robot. And God controls everything. And he controls life and death and whatever. But that's not the message. The message is not that you're just a robot and a puppet. The message is, recognize the fact that God created the foundation. He wants you to be dynamic in enhancing it. But he doesn't want you to think that you created the foundation. You can create any foundation you want. But don't misunderstand to think he doesn't want you to do anything. He wants you to just be a puppet. And he's just calls all the shots, and he decrees whether you're righteous or wicked or whatever, and you have no choice. That's not true. The proof to that is the first two miracles, that you shouldn't make the mistake of misunderstanding what God's changing water to blood. Not that I want to take away your ability to choose and to enhance and promote your life. I don't want to take away your water. I'm only showing you that if you turn my blood into water, I'll turn your water into blood. But otherwise, I want you to have that water. I want that water to be yours. I want you to enhance, but within the framework I gave you. I don't want you to do it outside that framework. What's the proof? The first two things. I gave you a world of a world that's not alive, that you can use to serve you. You can take a piece of wood, make it into a support, right, of a staff. You can use it for guidance. You can use it to change the world and make the bad into good. You have the power with that stick to do a tremendous amount of things. I want you to have that. But I have the power to turn that stick into a snake where the living world will be against you. And you can have, I created the material world to serve you. And I can turn that, if I wanted to, into something living that will be against you. But I don't. I leave it to that you should have that support. But I have that power. And I have the power to take your living hand, which also I created so that you can function. You can create with that hand. You can support yourself with that hand. And so much. And I can turn it into something dead, which is just a burden to you. So I have the power to do all of that, but I don't. I leave those living things that you can use them to for support, and the material world, the dead world, that you can use for support. I have the ability to turn everything upside down, but I don't. Why? Because I want you to be dynamic, but I don't want you to be dynamic in a way that you think you're substituting yourself for me. Recognize what I gave you. Recognize the latitude I gave you to function within a specific framework. But once you go out of that framework and you think that you can create the framework, then you're changing my blood into water. I'll change your water into blood. But I'm not trying to tell you that I don't want you to be dynamic. Baharaya, learn from the first two. The same thing with the remembering the day of death. If you remember the day of death without the first things, you could come to the wrong conclusion. Three wrong conclusions. So each one takes away a misconception. Same thing over here. The first two miracles put the third one into perspective, and then it's effective. But if it would just be the third one without the first two, you could totally misunderstand what the third one's telling you. You'd misunderstand to think that God doesn't want you to be dynamic. He wants you just to be a pawn, just to be a robot, just to be a puppet over here. That's not the intention. The intention is I want you to be dynamic, but I want you to be dynamic within the framework I made, not to create a different framework. And I think could be an idea here. One more. What else? What do we have time for? 5, 10 minutes. There we go. Let's no, it's the family. It says that when they were going to go out, we could do this in a different parasha, but we'll do it over here. When they were going to go out of Egypt, God told them to take gold and silver and Egyptian clothing and to put the Egyptian clothing on their children. So I understand the gold, the silver, take from the Egyptians. It's part of their wages. Why Egyptian clothing? What makes it even more difficult is that one of the merits they had to leave Egypt, they didn't wear Egyptian clothing. Here, God's telling him, take Egyptian clothing, put it on your children. What kind of, whether it was a masquerade party, what was the purpose of taking Egyptian clothing? I think the Rabbanu Shem wanted to give us a tremendous lesson, and that's the following. God wanted us to know there is nothing intrinsically wrong with that clothing. It's not shatnez, it wasn't not modest. Whatever could be wrong with clothing wasn't wrong with that clothing. The proof? When you go out of Egypt, I want you to put it on your kids. If there's something wrong with it, how could you put it on your kids? So I want you to take the clothing and wear it, put it on your children, no problem. It's perfectly okay, halachically, to wear that clothing. But had you worn that same clothing the last 210 years in Egypt, you wouldn't have gone out. How could that be? How could the clothing be halachically kosher, and yet if you would have worn it, you wouldn't go out? The answer is very simple. The clothing is halachically kosher in the desert, where you're not wearing it to be like an Egyptian. But in Egypt, you could wear 100% glatt kosher clothing, but if your reason to wear it is to be like an Egyptian, it's treif. Something can be intrinsically 100% okay. You won't find in the Shulchan Aruch anything against it. But in a certain time, in a certain place, it may stand for something that's wrong. I'll give you two examples. When I was in high school, so the rage in the world was the Beatles. Not the six-legged variety, but the two-legged variety. The rock band from Liverpool. And they started a fad in the world, which didn't exist before then, for respectable men to have long hair. Till then, only bohemians, hippies had long hair, men. But after, you know, Ringo Starr, the drummer, had long hair, and the other ones had long hair, and they were like, you know, the idol of the world. So lawyers, doctors, businessmen started growing and having long hair. It became respectable. So whatever affects the Goyish world affects the Jewish world too. So I was in a Nesifta high school, right, Yeshiva high school in Miami, and some of my friends stopped taking haircuts. And after about 3-4 months, it started looking like a co-ed school. So my Rebbeim called in these boys. I remember on Erev Shabbos, there was a group of 2-3 guys that, you know, thought they were cool and they had started having long hair. And the Rebbeim called them in and they said, you are to go and get a normal man's haircut for Shabbos. And if you do, we want you to come back on Sunday. But if you don't, do not show up here on Sunday. You are suspended until you get a normal haircut. So my friends were not daunted by that. And they said, but Rebbe, a Nazir lets his hair grow long and he's holy. We just want to be holy people with long hair. They said, you ever see the Ragachover going? The Ragachover, they say, never took a haircut because he didn't want to take off his yarmulke and he didn't want to stop learning. So he had a head of hair, mamish, like an afro. It was, ask somebody to show you a picture of the Ragachover, Rabbi Yosef Rosen. He was it's nogeya to you here because he was the Hasidish Rav in Dvinsk, opposite the Orsameach. Right? The Meir Simcha was the Litvish Rav, and the Hasidish Rav was the Ragachover. So he had a big head of hair. They said, Rebbe, we just want to be like the Ragachover. They told him, haircut or don't come here on Sunday. Why? It's true. There may be nothing halachically wrong with having long hair. A Nazir could be holy with long hair. And the Ragachover can have long hair. But if the reason you're growing long hair is to be like the Beatles, it's Treifi Chazer. It may be, according to Shulchan Aruch, 100% okay. But in your time, in your place, it stands for something that's no good. Another example. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, so I decided that Sukkos, I came in Elul, and the first Sukkos I had here, I brought my Sukkah with me from Miami. And I brought my sukkah decorations, but I said, you know what? I'm not going to bring chutz la'aretz here. I'm going to have Eretz Yisrael sukkah decorations. So I put my sukkah decorations away, and I went to Me'esharim to buy Israeli sukkah decorations. You know, make my sukkah Israeli sukkah, not a chutz la'aretz sukkah. So I get to close to the streets in Geula where they have all the sukkah decorations on tables. Something bothers me that from a distance these look very familiar. As I get closer, I see they're very familiar. They're Christmas decorations in the original packaging. It says Merry Christmas on it. And all these Yerushalmis are buying these Christmas decorations for their sukkahs. That's what they're selling. That is Israeli sukkah decorations. I was sure that Chol HaMoed, I would go into Me'esharim and see a sukkah with a little baby and some shepherds around or whatever. And I'm sure that these Yerushalmis, if they would go to New York now, this time of year, right? They would say, hey, these guys stole our sukkah decorations. They never saw a Christmas tree. They don't know a Christmas decoration. They can't read English. They say in English, it probably says sukkah decorations. What else is that? In Yerushalayim, could be there's nothing wrong with using those decorations. They have no meaning to them. But in Kutzlar, it's in America, you use those decorations, you're using goyish things. So what in one place may be 100% kosher v'yosher, in another place it stands for something, it's 100% treif. That's what the Rav Moshe wanted to teach us. The Egyptian clothing may be intrinsically 100% kosher. And I'll prove it to you. You can wear it in the desert. Put it on your children, no problem. But had you worn that same clothing the last 210 years in Egypt, you never would have gone out. Because the last 210 years in Egypt, it would have been, you've been wearing it to be like an Egyptian. That's treif, even though there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. When the Haskalah made the learning of Tanakh the substitute for learning Gemara, they don't believe in learning Gemara. Gemara is a waste of time. Tanakh, though, okay, we'll learn Tanakh. So the yeshivas stopped learning Tanakh. You want to know why you don't learn Tanakh here? Is because it's a throwback, right? So a leftover from the time of the Haskalah. Because then learning Tanakh was a symbol of rejecting Gemara. So the yeshiva stopped learning Tanakh. Something wrong with Tanakh? It's Torah. But it stood for something then, and therefore it became us. Doesn't stand for that anymore, so it really should get back into the curriculum. But in any case, it takes time for things to change. Long time. But that is the idea, and I think that's the lesson with the clothing of the Mitzrayim. The Kli Yochr says a more simple idea. I think what I told you is 100% true. Kli Yochr, just to tell you the Kli Yochr one, Kli Yochr says that usually when there's a mass death, like there was by Makas Bechoros, people think it's a plague. And when there's a plague, the first thing you do is burn all the clothing because you're afraid that what's it called, that it's contagious. So the Jews came for gold and silver, and the Egyptians said, why don't you take some of our clothing too? Because they thought that the clothing was contagious. They thought that their firstborn died in a plague. So they wanted to unload their clothing on the Jews. Here, take some contaminated clothing. So the Rebbe Moshe said, don't worry. I want you to take gold and silver. But when you go around, they're going to ask for clothes. They're going to ask to take clothing. Take it. Put it on your children. It's no danger. And it wasn't a plague that killed the firstborn. I killed the firstborn. So there's nothing contaminated about the clothing. Don't worry about it. Take it. You can wear it, whatever. That's what the Kli Yochr says. Okay.